We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. 90% of all American businesses are family-owned. Our guest with us hour, Robert Spector, says that they are survivors, enduring every new retail concept that's been thrown at them. He says they survive because we need them, and not just for the products they sell, but for the way that they connect us to our communities. He spent a couple of years traveling around the country, actually even in some other parts of the world, talking with men and women who run successful small businesses. And he says he did this at random as he traveled. He looked for recommendation, visited with them, and talked about all sorts of things. And he's written about this in a recently published book. And the title of the book is The Mom and Pop Store, subtitle How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving. And the publisher on the book is Walker & Company. And in this book, he says that the one thing that he was really interested in is finding people who could tell a good story. He says, looking back on the topics that they discussed, he found that they covered all of the important ones, quote, life, death, love, hate, family, friendship, neighborliness, hard work, entrepreneurship, creativity, adaptation, racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, civil rights, AIDS, immigration, capitalism, socialism, communism, war, freedom, urban renewal, sweet soul music, and corned beef on rye. Our guest, Robert Spector, is a business writer. He's written about big box stores. He's written about online retailing. He's been on CNN and ABC and PBS, many radio shows. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, certainly questions, comments from listeners are welcome. We just ask people to be brief and to be on the topic. Otherwise, your call is welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point, all you got to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. Mr. Spector, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Greetings from Seattle.
Well, I don't know what things are like out there in Seattle. Actually, here, kind of drizzly and overcast. It's probably kind of like Seattle weather. So
it sounds exactly like Seattle weather.
Well, you know, I know that you chose the title because you knew that when you say mom and pop store, everybody knows what that is.
Right, right. It's an iconic term, and I actually, you know, this book is part memoir. My parents had a butcher shop and a farmer's market in New Jersey, and I worked there, as did many of my family members. But I got a little pushback on the title because, you know, some people said, well, it's too quaint. You know, some people thought it was a put down. You're just a mom and pop operation. And others said, well, we're not a mom and pop, literally. And when I talk about the title, when I say mom and pop, I don't mean in every case literally. You know, a mother and a father. You know, in some cases, it's, you know, same sex partners who have the same business, or it's a father and a son, a mother and a daughter. But everybody knows, as you said, everybody knows what a mom and pop store is.
And one of the things I was interested to learn, you mentioned here, is that that's really not a very old term.
Right, yeah. I had a couple of professional librarians, including one from Purdue, in fact, who's a friend of mine, check it out. And it only goes back to 1962, which I thought this had been around for years. But according to the Oxford English Dictionary, it was only first used by a publication of the BBC radio called The Listener, which is an apt term, and it said these mom-and-pop stores certainly don't like the big supermarkets.
Yeah.
Of course, they still don't.
And they still don't, yeah. And they don't like the whatever big box store. I suppose if you're a little hardware store, you're not going to be real happy about Lowe's. Or, you know, if you're a small electronics store, you're not going to be happy about you know, Circuit City, are they the ones that are out of business?
Circuit City is RIP.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Whatever is the other, you know.
Yeah, Best Buy.
Best Buy. There you go. Right. So, yes, no matter what business you're in, you're not going to be happy about those bigger stores. And I suppose that's one of the things that's remarkable is that online retailers and big box stores haven't somehow managed to put all the mom and pops out of business.
Right. In fact, you know, as you mentioned, I've written about big box stores, and I also wrote the first book about Amazon.com, which is, of course, based here in Seattle. Have they hurt those businesses? Well, obviously, of course. You know, every little bit takes a little bite out of small independent businesses. But you have to figure out a way to survive and to adapt to change. And the stores that I feature in the mom and pop store have figured out a way to survive. And I interviewed some 35 stores over the course of a couple of years, and they're all still in business. And that's you know, figuring out a way, how am I going to make it? How am I going to change my product line, add something new, get closer to the customer, all those things that you need to do in order to survive.
Yeah. I wonder, is there some sort of statistic that says if you survive X number of years, then you're likely to survive long term?
Well, you know, I haven't seen that, but I've seen the numbers of stores that last more than one generation. And by the time it gets to the fourth generation, it's maybe like 3% of all businesses. But in fact, I interviewed people who are in the fifth generation of their business. There's a meat market in Cincinnati called Wassler's, which is in the fifth generation. There's an ice cream maker in Philadelphia called Bassett's. For anyone from Philadelphia, you ask them what their favorite ice cream is, it's Bassett's, and they've been selling it since the 1880s. So it's they have a combination of a good product and the fact that family members are still excited about doing it and finding ways to continue to connect to the community.
Yeah.
You can't do business the way you did it in previous generations.
Well, you talked about the fact that growing up, your family had a butcher shop in New Jersey, and I know that you worked there when you were a kid, and I know that you said you hated it.
Absolutely.
And so I suppose that would suggest that there are two kinds of people, at least, when you talk about people who grew up that way, and that is those who continued the business, went into the business, and those who said, I'm out of here as fast as I possibly can, and they want to do something else. And you wonder what exactly makes the difference.
Right. Well, you know, I did not for one split second ever think that I would take over my father's business, nor did my father ever think that I would either. But I am fascinated with people who go into the family business, and especially the ones, as I mentioned, the multi-generational, you know, the fascination of it. And, you know, I think part of it is family pride. Part of it, you know, as I talk about in the book, that one of the advantages that those of us who grew up working in mom and pop stores is that we get to see what our parents actually do for a living. And not only do we get to see it, we get to be there, experience, and do part of it ourselves. So we get a chance to see what it's like and make that decision whether we want to be in it. You know, some of the people I interviewed from the book who started, just like I did, going as a kid, just fell in love with it, fell in love with the energy, the activity, all the things that go along with it. And, you know, and I just find that utterly fascinating because I went in the completely opposite direction.
Well, that suggests that some people who do this, who go on in the family business, go in with eyes open because they know what it's like. Then there, I'm sure, are a lot of people who, for whatever reason, just have this dream of having their own business. And for them, it may be a little bit more abstract because they
right.
don't really know what it's going to be like. But at the same time, in some folks, the idea of being your own boss is very powerful.
Absolutely. And I think that you're seeing this now with people being downsized and looking for work. You know, a lot of people have said, you know, one of these days I'd love to open up a fill-in-the-blank store because, you know, that's my hobby, it's my passion. Well, for a lot of the people, this is one of these days. One of these days has arrived. And there are people, and I'm sure, you know, you know people who are no longer satisfied with their job, but they've got, you know, grandma's recipe for cupcakes, you know, in a file box. And see, that was a really great cupcake. I wonder if we could make this a commercial product or whatever your passion is, the thing that you want to do. People want to. There is a certain number of people who want to then start their own business. Now, what they need to know is what it takes. It is tough to be your own boss. It is tough to run a business, especially retail, because in retail you get a report card every day, and you are constantly being buffeted by competition, by changes in the neighborhood, changes in the marketplace. That's why when I use the subtitle, the unsung heroes, these are heroes. These are people who actually generate jobs, contribute to our community. So we need to find ways to support those people.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the things that I certainly know is true from having gotten to know maybe a little bit some people who have businesses like that here where I live is that they're always working. It seems extremely difficult, maybe even impossible, to get time away from the business. It seems that they're always there, and I expect that probably when they're not there, they're still thinking about it.
Right. Yeah. I interviewed a couple. I live in Seattle. There's a town north of Seattle, actually closer to Vancouver, British Columbia, called Bellingham, and it's a college town. And the husband and wife who run this, Chuck and his wife Dee Robinson, have had Village Books there for 30 years, and they talk about it all the time. And they said, but for us, you know, it isn't a burden. You know, we really enjoy, you know, talking about the business and what's going on, the people we hired, and the events that we're doing. But yes, it is a demanding mistress, you might say, because there's always something to do in the business, whether it's ordering, doing the bookkeeping, you name it. There's a million different jobs. So yeah, you really have to be dedicated to it because it becomes another family if your family is not, you know, directly involved in it.
Well, and that, again, I think that points to another one of the realities of having small business is that you have to be the proverbial jack of all trades.
Right.
You know, you have to know how to do the thing. What it's providing a service, it's making something, it's whatever it is. So you got to do that. But then, say maybe you're in the food business. Well, you have to know about buying the materials you need, and you have to make sure you buy them at a good price because you have to make money, and you have to know something about personnel management, probably because you have employees, and then you have payroll, and then you have accounting that you have to think about, and you've got to pay your taxes, and maybe you pay somebody to help you with that, but I expect that a lot of people have to do all of that themselves, and maybe if something breaks, you got to figure out how to fix it, and then at the end of the day, when the store's closed, you're mopping the floor. It means you kind of have to be able to take care of all of those things.
Well, you know, I say in the book that being the owner of a small business is more demanding and requires more skills than being the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, because there basically you can delegate responsibility and look at the big picture. Well, you know, when you're the owner of a mom and pop store, you're looking at the big picture, but you're also looking at all the details in the picture as well, for all the things that you described. So that's why, you know, when we read about startup businesses and those businesses that fail, or businesses that go into bankruptcy, you know, behind those negative numbers, it's just a matter of the law of averages. You know, X amount of people are going to try a new business, and you know, and a certain subset of that are going to fail. And you know, I don't think it isn't necessarily a negative. It's just a reality. Some people know how to do this, and some people don't. And some people who know how to do it may just get burned out and say, I can't do it anymore because of all the things that we talked about, all the demands that it makes on you.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Spector. He's a business writer, and we are talking about his recent book, The Mom and Pop Store, How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving. That's the subtitle. It's published by Walker & Company, and it's the result of a couple of years that he spent traveling around the country talking with people who had these kinds of small businesses and trying to get to know them and talking about their experiences. He's authored a number of books. Some of them have to do with big business. For example, The Nordstrom Way to Customer Service Excellence and Category Killers, The Retail Revolution and Its Impact on Consumer Culture. But he's also written this book that really looks at, he's looked at the big end of things, and this really looks at the smaller end of things. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. This book is in part a memoir. So you do spend some time here writing about Spector's Meat Market, your dad's place where you worked and then decided slicing meat was not the thing that you wanted to spend your life doing. Tell us about Spector's Meat Market. What was it like?
Well, this was a classic immigrant business started by my paternal grandfather and my father and my uncle. And it was in a town, the town of Perth Amboy is in the New York metropolitan area. It's across the Raritan Bay from Staten Island, New York, so about 30 miles from midtown Manhattan, but very much of a self-contained melting pot community. And the lot upon which the farmer's market rested was basically empty for most of the week, other than Wednesdays and Saturdays, which was the big market day. So, and even from the old days, from the 1700s, farmers would bring their wagons and set up, you know, their fruits and vegetables, etc. And in my era, of course, people would drive their trucks. So imagine a paved walkway about 15 feet wide, starting from a street, heading down about a couple of hundred feet toward the end, which is where Spector's Meat Market was. So we were kind of the T square, and we had garage doors that would open up onto to the market. So you're out there in the cold in the winter, and the hot and humidity in the summer, and we would get. Most of my father's customers were Eastern European immigrants like himself, and he could sell his wares in Ukrainian and Russian and various Slavic languages, and he'd carry ethnic specialty foods that the supermarket around the corner didn't carry, and he had a very loyal clientele. And when I interviewed a man who worked for my father just on Saturday, he told me, I was always amazed to see these customers standing out in the cold. And we could have people standing out at, you know, 7 o'clock in the morning in 20-degree weather waiting to get food, most of which they could have gotten in a lot warmer place. But, you know, my father created this loyal clientele, and that's what helped pay for college educations for my sisters and me. Mm. You know, by the way, I have a cousin who worked in the market who was a professor at University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana named Paul Handler, who has passed away, but he was a pretty well-known professor there. So if there's anybody out there who remembers Paul Handler, he once worked there in the farmer's market as well. We had the same grandfather.
Right. Well, let's talk with somebody here. We have a caller in Peoria, and they're on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just wanted to ask a question in terms of internet sales versus local sales. My impression is that Congress has been very favorable to increasing internet sales to the extent of not, which do not, of course, provide local real estate taxes and local employment. So right. I just wanted to know what your take is on it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I wrote a book about Amazon.com, and of course, they are one of the companies that is fighting to make sure that internet companies don't have to pay taxes. I have to pay tax on Amazon products that I buy because they have a presence, obviously, in the state of Washington, where I live. But, you know, you in Illinois wouldn't have to, or Indiana wouldn't have to do that. I think that where we're headed is that eventually those sales are going to be taxed because they're essentially giving people, internet retailers, it's not necessarily a free ride, but certainly giving them a competitive advantage over local businesses. And you're starting to see that those moves in Congress, they're being thwarted. But I think eventually, people will be paying additional taxes on sales from the internet.
Okay. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number or the calls on us. That raises in my mind the question of expanding to some kind of online presence and trying to do some online retailing, and whether some of the people that you talk to, the mom and pops, have realized that that's something that they need to do to expand their potential customer base.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. In fact, there's a bakery in Chicago called Dinkle's Bakery on Lincoln Avenue, which is third generation in the business, and I interviewed the current owner, Norm Dinkle, who's the grandson of the founder. And you know, when his grandfather and father started the business, it was the bakery business was a 7-day week business. These days, it's a weekend business, and you get a few people coming in during the week. So he has got a very robust internet business for expatriate Chicagoans who still want the kind of Polish bakery goods that Dinkle sells. So he's doing a lot on the internet, and as he told me, the internet business makes up for the fact that business is pretty slow during the week. And you know, and that's one of the recurring things of the people who I did interview in the book. Most of them have at least a website, and you know, according to the product they sell, they have a nice business on the internet. So you can't just do things the way you've always done it. You have to adapt to what's available to you now. And I think what Dinkle's is doing is a perfect example of it.
Yeah, the one of the things that comes across real clear from the people that you talk to is that for the people who work in these businesses, whether they are the owners or whether they're people that work there and they're it's not their business but they work there, that the experience of working in these businesses has been for them a very important formative experience. I think you even say that of yourself, even though,
right,
as we've said, you decided, well, you didn't want to work in the butcher shop, but that thinking about it now, looking back, even you would say, well, yeah, actually, I could see how that helped make me the person that I am.
Oh, absolutely. And it as I write in the book, it took me until about age 50 to figure it out. And you know, people have asked me why it took me so long. I guess I said, I guess I'm just slow. I don't know, but yet truly it's very, very simple lessons. And when I talk about these lessons that I learned, I said, I didn't even think I had been paying attention. So it took me a long time, but I'll explain very, very briefly the sequence. In the mid '90s, I wrote this book on Nordstrom, and it became a bestseller. People started asking me to speak on customer service, and I started to reflect back on the kind of customer service that my parents gave. And I would tell, so I'm finding myself speaking to companies like Pfizer and Dell and Charles Schwab. And I said, now, before I learned about customer service from Nordstrom, I learned about it from my parents. And I put up a slide of my parents and my two older sisters. And I would tell stories about working at Spector's Meat Market. And and tell people all that is to say is customer service is the same thing, whether it's Spector's Meat Market, it's fill-in-the-blank of the group I'm speaking to, or it's Nordstrom, that would segue me back to Nordstrom. Invariably, people will come up to me and say, I love those stories about your father, because it's not corporate stuff, it's a farmer's market. And to make the point that this is all very simple, this whole idea of customer service, it's the execution and the doing it that's the challenging part. And but I learned honesty. I learned to be nice to people, and all these basic things that I'm self-employed. So these are all things that I take with me, and I have taken with me my entire life.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, let me introduce once again, is business writer Robert Spector. Among his books are Amazon.com, Get Big Fast, The Nordstrom Way to Customer Service Excellence, Category Killers, The Retail Revolution, and Its Impact on Consumer Culture. So clearly he's written some books about some very big businesses. His new book is about small business, and it's titled The Mom and Pop Store, the subtitle How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving, and it's published by Walker and Company. His work has appeared in lots of places, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today. He's appeared on CNN, ABC, Fox, PBS, NPR's Marketplace Report, and we're glad to have him spending a little time with us. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. There's a real important, I think, central idea here. And you talk about the fact that the subtext of the book is community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really very striking if you think about it, how the interactions between the customer and the person serving them is, it's not just an economic interaction, I mean it is, but it's also a social interaction.
Right. Well, there I have a line in the In introduction to the book by the writer Christopher Caldwell, who writes for the Financial Times, and he described retail as the exciting place where the economic order and the social order meet. And I just thought that was just so up, where the economic order and the social order meet. Yes, you are going to your local store, whether you're in a place where you get your coffee or your breakfast in the morning, or the local grocery store, hopefully you have one, but you're not just there just to buy stuff. You're also there to catch up on little community gossip. You know, what's going on? Who got married? Who passed away? Who had a baby? What new businesses are coming in? All that stuff, and we all need the marketplace. And as I mentioned, I wrote this book on Amazon.com, and I was writing about it in the late 90s, and when the internet bubble was continuing to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and the so-called experts were saying, well, we're not going to need brick-and-mortar stores anymore because we're all going to order everything we need online at 2 o'clock in the morning in our pajamas.
Mm-hmm.
That was obviously ridiculous, because we need to be in the marketplace, not just to buy stuff, but to find out what's going on, to talk with our neighbors, the people in our community. And I don't think that will ever change, even with all the technology that we have and all the tweeting and Facebooking and everything else. We still want to communicate with other people. And that's why these kinds of stores will always be with us.
And that's something I suppose I hadn't really thought very much about. That is, if you go to a big box store, the people there indeed may be, I'm sure they're very fine people, and they're friendly and they're helpful, and they're trying to get you what you need. But every time you go, chances are you're going to deal with somebody different. And the kind of businesses we're talking about here, you actually have the opportunity to establish some kind of relationship with a person, because maybe there's just a small number of employees, and every time you go in, you're going to see the same people. And that
right.
just it's a natural sort of thing for that developing into more than just I want this thing, and here's how much it costs, and here's my money, and thanks, and bye.
Exactly. Well, the old TV show Cheers, the theme song, where everybody knows your name. And that's we like going into a place where they know who we are. That's just a natural part of the human condition. And I write a little bit about the joy of having a usual order when you go to your place. For those of us who drink coffee, who like to have a latte or a cappuccino when we go to our favorite place, and they not only know our name, but they know our order. And either that, or you know, go to a bartender, or going to a restaurant where the thing that you like, and people know that's your order, and it's a bonding thing between you and that person on the other side of the counter, and that kind of personal touch, to me, if you can put it in monetary terms, it is worth something. It is worth something more than just getting the absolute cheapest price that you can. Now, I understand, you know, in these tough economic times, people need to save money and need to find, you know, something as inexpensive as possible. But if you take the long-term view, and if you see, well, if I support this small business, especially in these tough times, they're going to be here when I need them. And that's all a part of that connection to that community. You know, if we want these stores to survive, it's very simple. We give them our business.
Yeah. In early America, I'm sure most of the businesses were mom-and-pop stores.
Right.
That's not to say that there weren't big global corporations at the time, because there were.
Well,
but
Sears was certain, you know, Sears and Montgomery Ward, you know, were behemoths, as is the AMP, which was the biggest retailer in the country in the 1930s.
Yeah.
You know, most people don't realize that AMP was the Walmart of its day. You know, not only did it have 13,000 stores, but they had their own magazine, they had their own radio station, and you know, look at AMP today; they're a mere shell of what they once were.
Yeah. Do you? I wonder, as you talk to the people, whether people who have small businesses, whether, I don't know if this is too lofty a kind of a idea to kick around, but whether they have this sense that they have in American history that they have an important place.
Well, you know, some of them realize that. Others were just, well, this is just what we do. They weren't looking, you know, at you mentioned a lofty thing. They weren't quite looking at it in those terms, and I'm hoping that when people read the mom and pop store, that they understand that the importance of these businesses. I think for the most part, the people who have these businesses were looking more, you know, at ground level, looking at their part in the community, their part in, you know, helping their own family succeed in America. You know, there are many immigrant stories in my book, whether people came from Asia or Mexico, Cuba, but the whole idea of being able to establish something in the United States and to be able to build something for their family, whether their children went into the business was really secondary to being able to have their own business. There are many parents who discourage their children from going into the business. They say, "Well, you know, you're not going to make you know, that much money." And but the ones who decided to go into it said it was more than just money. One of my favorite stores is a delicatessen in Newark, New Jersey, which is where I was born, and it's the there are only two Jewish delis left in Newark, and this one is called Hobbies. And the two sons of the owner, one went to my alma mater, Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. The other went to Brandeis. And their father didn't want them to be slinging corned beef. He wanted them to be a doctor or a lawyer. But they love the place, and they love working with their father. And as one of them, Michael Brummer, said to me, you know, there are people who are wealthier than we are, but nobody is richer than we are, because very few people know their father as well as we know our father.
Well, that's a really great story, and one that I would hope would warm anybody's heart and would say, you know, if it wasn't that way for them, there's a little part of them that says they wish that it was.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, it was just a beautiful thing. You know, to hear them say, you know, it isn't like they're in poverty, but you know, they're in a they could certainly have made a whole lot more money and worked worked less harder than they are now. But you know, it's all a trade-off, and you have to figure out what is your priority.
Yeah. Let us talk with another caller here. We have somebody in Clay City. This is on our line one. Hello.
Yes, I've run a small business, and I've been involved in business off and on all my life. And I run into a lot of people that say, I want to start a small business. And if you talk to them very long, then I have a tendency to discourage them from doing it, because a lot of them say, well, I just want to work on Wednesday afternoons. Well, I'd like to do the booking, but I'll hire somebody to do that. And I think you should bring out the point that they shouldn't have any illusions that out of 10 businesses that start, maybe 3 make it. There's a certain amount of passion you have to have, but you also have to have the go-to and the get-with and the I got to do this kind of thing. You know, the deli didn't open up at 2 in the afternoon. It opened up at 6 o'clock in the morning. The guy was right. Putting stuff in the cooler, and he may be there 12 hours a day, you know, before he walks out the door. So there's a certain amount of passion, but there's a lot of stick-to-itiveness that goes along with that. I'd like you to bring that point out, too. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. I could not agree with you more. Yeah, you know, I think most people you should try and discourage from starting a business because of all the things that you talked about, and especially in these times, because I've done some follow-ups with a few people who are featured in the book, and in these times more than ever, it's important for the owner to show his or her face in the place, that you really need to be there to. Reaffirm the fact that you are a part of this community, and that this is your business, and it is your responsibility. One of the stories I feature in the book is a place, a coffee shop called Gallery Espresso in Savannah, Georgia. It's right near the Savannah College of Art and Design, and the woman who runs it, Judy Davis, runs it with her daughter. Bought it about 10 or 11 years ago, and she was really the first coffee house in Savannah. Starbucks hadn't even gotten there yet, and she was working there for a couple of years, and this guy would come in and take notes and talk to her about the business, and he eventually opened up his own business, but he hired somebody else to actually do it, and it went out of business in less than a year. She said, because if it's your business, you have to be there. You have to do all these things. You have to make the decisions, do all the things we talked about earlier, do the hiring, the firing, the buying, the merchandising. You know, the list goes on and on and on. And if people are not prepared to do all that, and a whole lot more that they haven't even thought of yet, do not become a small business person.
Yeah, it makes me again think about how, you know, for some people, they get up and they go to work and they go to the job and they do that, and then at the end of the workday they go home, and that's, you know, that's and the rest of their life is completely separate. And one of the things that seems to me to be a sort of a hallmark of having your own business is that kind of separation, it just isn't there. You're the work that you do, that is your business. It pretty much is your life.
That's right. And that can take its toll. It can take its toll on relationships, whether with your spouse or your children or your partner. That's why over time these businesses ultimately stop being in business. There's a myriad of reasons. It's not purely economic. It's social. It's familial. You know, all these things. But so you really have to want to do it. It's like, you know, somebody who wants to be an actor or a singer, and it can't be a part-time thing. You have to want it more than you want anything else, because you're going to have to put up with rejection and disappointment, and you have to find a way to keep going. So therefore, it just has to be a compelling aspect of your personality. Other than that, don't go into it, because it's too frustrating, too difficult, and you know, find something easier to do.
How I wonder how many people end up going into business for themselves because they start with a passion for the product. I mean, that is it's the thing. Maybe they love coffee, they love books, they love great cheese, you know, who knows? Maybe they love nuts and bolts, you know, whatever it is. But it starts because there's something that they're just really, really passionate about.
Sure, you know, and that's the passion is necessary. It's a requirement, but it can't be just about the passion. It has to be... you know, once you get beyond the passion, it's all those mundane things that we talked about. You know, I speak to a lot of small businesses, and when I speak to booksellers, you know, I'll ask them, how many people in the room got into bookselling because you love books, and everybody would raise their hand. And then I ask them, how many of you got into this business because you love selling books? And that's an entirely different
not so
question.
Many hands go up, I'm
right,
sure.
Right, and as you know, I mentioned earlier this Chuck Robinson, who owns Village Books in Bellingham, Washington, said that again. He and his wife have been doing this for 30 years. He said, if you want to get into this because you love reading books, become a night watchman. You'll have much more time to read books than you would as the owner of a bookstore.
Yeah. Our guest, let me introduce again, our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Robert Spector. He's a business writer, and the book that we're talking about is The Mom and Pop Store. That's the title. It has a kind of long subtitle. It is How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving. But if you're looking for the book, look for The Mom and Pop Store. It's published by Walker and Company. And we have about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with our guest. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You know, I think that often when we hear about small business, or maybe we hear these kind of business people talking, or the organizations that represent them, there's a lot of talk about government and what it does or doesn't do, and about the difficulties they have dealing with regulations, the difficulties that they have dealing with taxes. Increasingly, we have heard about the problems that they have in trying to provide health care for their workers. Did people want to talk about those things?
Yeah, absolutely. I didn't get as much into the healthcare aspect of it as I did in just the nickel and diming of local businesses, or rather of local governments, because whether it's, you know, you have to sweep the front of your the sidewalk in front of your store by a certain time, or else you get a fine. And you know, small businesses are like you know, they're the bottom feed for a lot of governments, because they don't have a team of lawyers to fight particular you know, taxes or fees or whatever. And I think that and I think President Obama is starting to see that. He was announcing how they're want to allow some more TARP money for small businesses, and I think that that's important, because it's going to be the small businesses, the businesses that I've been talking about in the Mom and Pop Store book, they're going to help to bring the economy back. It's not going to be the large chain stores. They aren't hiring. They're not expanding. So if we're looking for job growth, we need to find ways to encourage and give tax breaks in whatever form that takes to small businesses, and to generate, you know, those jobs, because they'll eventually generate taxes and you know, things like that. And the problem is most people who are in political office have never run a business. You know, I think probably the last president we had who actually worked in a business was Harry Truman, who was a haberdasher, which is an ancient word, but you know, he sold clothes.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to my CPA, who does a lot with small businesses, and he rattled off five things that you could that Congress could do right now to make life easier for small businesses, including acceleration of depreciation of equipment. So that's what I'd like to see. I would like to see our elected officials find ways to help and not hinder small business.
We have several callers. We'll see if we can get them in the time that remains. So we'll talk first with someone on a cell phone on our line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank
you.
Well, I found the comment about wanting to read books. You better become a night watchman pretty appropriate. I think a lot of people go. I've run 4 small businesses, and I think a lot of people go into small business for that very reason. You know, they're interested in this, so you think it'd be great, I'll be able to do this. No. If you like to do paperwork, if you like to deal with bureaucrats, if you like to do taxes, become a small businessman.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is that your business is doing, you're not going to have much to do with that. And if you think you're going to hire other people to do that stuff, you will have plenty left for yourself whatsoever, and you'll just go bankrupt. Actually, I think the interesting thing you might want to speak to is the definition of small business. I believe that when politicians refer to small businesses, they're talking about businesses with 50 or more employees or maybe 100 or more. They are not talking about mom-and-pop stores, the type of businesses that I'm sure most of us think of as a small business. They're not talking about a single proprietorship restaurant. Those businesses are not even on their radar. They do not see them. They're not there to them. And the result is all the bad part of regulation gets the small business, and any benefits never reach them. I would say if anybody out there is listening about starting a small business, don't. It is a total mirage. You will be miserable. The only thing you'll be able to say to yourself is nobody else can boss you around. But, you know, you're going to be broke. I think it's a complete myth that is taught to us when we're in high school and college that everything is on the up and up out there. It is not on the up and up. This country is set up for Walmart and Home Depot. It's set up for huge conglomerates and monopolies, and small businesses are, forget it.
Well, let me, Mr. Spector, what do you have to say about what the caller had to say?
Well, you know, I was with him about 90% through the call. And when I said, you know, tell people don't do it, you're going to be miserable. That I have to disagree with, based on the people who I know, you know, not only the people who I met along the way, but actually in the last chapter of the book, I look at the businesses that my wife and I frequent in our neighborhood in Seattle, and it isn't all about just the money. It's about the connection to the community. It's about the things that they can contribute to the community, being on their own. Yes, is it tough? Absolutely. And again, most of what that gentleman said is absolutely right. But in spite of all that, there are still going to be people today who are going to be going into a business because it's a dream. They don't want to work for somebody else. Whatever the circumstances is, people are going to do it. People are always going to do it. This is a concept that's been around for 6,000 years, and there's a reason for that, and that's because these kinds of businesses fulfill a purpose. Do the tax laws work in their favor? No. Do local municipalities help them out for the most part? No. But even with all that, there are still going to be people who are going to be starting a new business today, somewhere.
We'll try real quick, at least one more call. Line 1, this is Champagne. Hello.
Is this me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I've worked for myself for the last 30-plus years and really enjoy working for myself, and I've often said working for yourself is great. You can work anytime you want to, pick any 12 hours out of each day, and it's pretty much the way that it works. I really have enjoyed working for myself, but have never made tons of money hand over fist, but really liked doing what I do and getting my hands dirty and being in the middle of it, and have often said there's a small business and there's big business, but there's no such thing as a middle-sized business. And once you get past the small business mentality of wanting to get bigger, you're a big business and you have hundreds of employees and you're a manager. You're not doing the kinds of things that you really enjoy doing, and your job changes dramatically.
Well, again, we're just almost out of time. Any sort of last kind of I want to thank the caller, first of all, and say to you, Robert Spector, any last kind of thing you want to say here?
Well, I guess the most important thing is that go out and support your local independent retailer, because that's the best way you can ensure that that they will remain and that the vitality of your community, your neighborhood, the place where you buy your things, that's what's going to ensure the strength and the vitality of the place where you live.
Yeah. Well, there we have to leave it. If you'd like to read the book again, it's titled The Mom and Pop Store, How the Unsung Heroes of the American Economy Are Surviving and Thriving, by our guest, business writer Robert Spector. And Mr. Spector, thanks very much.
Thank you, David. I enjoyed it.